Okay, it looks like everybody's back, so let's get into the final leg and we'll get you out of here on time. Interestingly, during the break, somebody informed me that there's large usage of cachet here, and in cachet, if, then, else, is in fact valid. So it's the more things change, the more they stay the same. It turns out that what I didn't say, and really is relevant also, is that this notion of reserve words, like if, can be carried too far. There's a well-known language called COBOL, which has existed a long time, and is fairly widely used, certainly was, and is still in use, that has page after page after page of reserve word, so much so that you can choose perfectly reasonable-sounding identifiers, put them in your program, and find they're unusable because they're reserved. I remember an example in COBOL, the word zero, Z-E-R-O, is reserved. Who knows why? Turns out also zeros with an S is reserved. Turns out also zeros with an E-S is reserved. So it's a sort of situation like a bureaucrat making things top secret. Once you get the stamp at reserved, you hard time to control yourself. So modern languages have a number of reserved words, but not a huge number. And I think that's the accepted practice now. So as I was saying, a compiler will be really these two phases. One will be to essentially analyze the program, to find out if it's valid under all the rules we have, and then to synthesize a working version of it that can actually be run on our processors. One of the things we're going to have to decide, because we're the people implementing the compiler and doing the programming, is really what's valid or not. It's something that doesn't come into play too often, but there are questions about should a program that has an obvious error in it be allowed to be used? Does anybody have any feeling? If I point to this thing and say, this part is wrong, it can't possibly be valid, should I say, well, This program is tainted, fix it, and then come back and we'll talk about it? Part of that is experience. I know many of you are well paid here because I was going through the garage and I saw some really nice looking automobiles. One of the worst things about having a new car is not having a new car, but waiting for the first dent or the first scratch. I had a car, and for a while it was pristine. But now I'm parking in the faculty parking lot. You probably know it. It's the one right next to Camp Randall, the big five-story one. And boy, does that get its share of crazy drivers. So year after year, I got a little ding in this bumper, a little dent in that one. And all of a sudden, my notion of perfection gets less and less and less. But it really is an issue that comes into play. For example, sometimes people will write down something like, quite intentionally. So it says I equals 1 divided by 0. That is, 0 divide is considered invalid in virtually every programming language. It's not infinity. Some people think it is. It's undefined. So the question is, why would you write something like that in a program intentionally? It's certainly the case that you might somehow do a divide by 0, not expecting that a dividend was going to be 0. No, the divisor. I'm sorry. Dividend divisor. My old instructors in Catholic school would be after me for not remembering. Well, the reason is sometimes it's a way to terminate a program, to sort of do a panic call or an emergency. You say, if I ever see occasion come up there where I know something's going wrong in a program, I'm going to terminate it. There are a variety of ways to terminate a program, but one way is to force an error. And in some ways, by doing something like this, it's a way of saying it's a user-enforced error rather than an unexpected error. That is, the user knew something is wrong and said, panic, I'm out of here. So one of the things we're going to have to decide as we analyze a program is what's valid and what's not. And it's not an easy decision, and something which I'll show you multiple examples of, where do we allow this or do we not. Some of the worst cases are where something looks valid, is valid, but probably shouldn't be valid. Well, what kind of nonsense is this? Let me show you an example of that. So this is a variation on a for loop. And the only thing that I've done unexpectedly, and this is something that's commonly done, is put a semicolon here. Well, programming languages use semicolons pretty routinely. It's more as like sipping a bottle of water or drinking a cup of coffee, no big deal. But here's the problem. Some programming languages in the early days created something called a null statement. What's a null statement? It's a statement that contains nothing. And a null statement is where you don't want to do anything. But what this program does is not what you'd expect in that sort of language. This thing does not go from I equals 1, well, less than 0, duh. Sorry, wrote that too fast, make that 10. While I is less than 10, increment it. It says, for that number of iterations, do the null statement, and then print I, probably with I equal to 10. The reason is this notion of using semicolons freely and allowing the null statement don't mix. And sometimes the worst errors are errors where you could look at that for days and not realize why it's doing wrong, because it's a valid program doing something not what's expected. So part of what we do when we define languages and analyze them is saying, not only is this valid, but is it likely to be what the user really wanted? That's sort of getting into their head, and that's not always easy. Sometimes we get to the point where we try to over-control the user, and that's a negative thing also. I don't know what they do here, but I am in the computer science building at the university right across from the New Union South, and they have a little area where they sell various beverages, legal beverages, sodas, juices, etc. I went in there one time coming back from home, and I wanted to buy a pint of whole milk. They do not stock whole milk. Why? Some bureaucrat has decided whole milk is unhealthy. They have 2%, 1% skim, but not whole milk. Well, looking at me, you say, well, he doesn't need whole milk. But actually, it turns out that I was buying it for my cat. My cat likes milk, and I was out of milk, and I was going to buy it for the cat, and his cat wanted a little treat. They wouldn't sell it to me. So there's a case, I think, probably particularly since virtually all the people in Union South are as young or younger than you, as healthy or healthier than you, and probably almost all of you have drunk a pint of whole milk and lived to tell the tale. So we have to be careful when we're analyzing programs that we don't get overly protective. It's not necessarily our job to tell a programmer what he or she may do, but it is perhaps our job to warn them about things like this that almost certainly are wrong. So just a little bit of insight there. And we talked about semantic analysis doing the translation. What some compilers do is generate an intermediate form that's executable in theory, but not the actual executable code. We're going to bypass that step and generate code directly, mostly in the matter of efficiency. But one of the nice things about creating an intermediate representation is that it allows me to change the executable form of the program before I bind what machine it's going to execute on. And in some situations, that's very useful, but it's a tad more advanced than we're going to do. So we saw earlier a 10,000-foot view of a compiler. Now we're going to see a view actually of what you're going to implement. And this is the 100-foot view where you're in a little plane just driving, flying over the airspace and looking at all the things. So each of these is a little component. Maybe it's one of the buildings you have linked together in whatever way. So what happens is we start our program up in the upper left. At that stage, it's simply a text file, a sequence of characters. It may be a valid program, or it may be a first couple of lines of a novel by Charles Dickens. And it's going to be transformed by first going right, but then I ran out of space, so then I decided to go down. And right in the center, right here, are symbol tables, which is the thing you're actually doing in Project 1 that's interacted with all the components of the compiler. It says, give me information about how the user defined the components of the compiler. What did he or she mean this to be, that to be? Was it initialized? Was it uninitialized? Is it used or is it unused? All sorts of information. So the component you're writing is actually a very important component throughout the process. But after that, the next component, Project 2, is going to be a scanner. That's going to actually do what I talked about, going to take individual characters and piece them together, sometimes in non-trivial ways, into valid words of language. In some cases, it's easy. Other cases, it's not so easy because we have some tokens that are more complex than others. One of the ones you'll see as we go do our project is a quoted string. In Java, as in most programming languages, a quoted string has single or double quotes. We use double quotes. And a series of characters in between that represent the body of the string. The problem is that there are certain characters that are magic. One of them is double quotes. Suppose, for example, I wanted to say, if A or B, then not okay, but okay in quotes. I might be tempted to write that. But that's going to fail, because it's going to trick the scanner. Why is it going to trick the scanner? Well, the intuitive definition of a string is it begins with a double quote and it ends with a double quote. But that was not my intention in writing this. So what this would say is, that's a string. Then okay is not part of the string as far as it's concerned, but it's rather an identifier, probably an identifier that's undeclared and get an error message. That's going to be confusing. And then I'm going to have a string with no text at all in it. Question is that valid or not? That's something we haven't decided yet. Is a string that has no characters in it valid? In most languages, the answer is yes. For example, if you have a string variable, the empty string is a nice initializer. But there was at least one language where empty strings were disallowed. Why? Well, in that language, a string was essentially an array of characters. Okay, that makes sense. That's a way to implement a string. But that language does not allow arrays of size 0. So if it's an array of characters, you can't have an array of size 0. Therefore, you couldn't have an empty string. Sometimes good intentions lead to bad results. But from our point of view, when we're building a scanner, we're going to have a rule. You may have learned a rule, may have forgotten about it or not. But if I want a double quote inside of a string, I've got to do a special action called escaping. How do you escape? Well, you use a backslash. And a backslash in front of a quote, double quote, means don't consider this to be a terminator. Consider it to be literally the double quote character. That's fine. But now we also have characters that are invisible. For example, tab and new line. And you almost certainly have used new line occasionally in strings because it's a way to force a new line and to do some elementary formatting. So a new line is backslash n. But now the scanner has to know when I say backslash n, I don't want two characters, the backslash followed by the n. I want one character spelled out as two characters. That's the invisible new line character. And we'll talk about that because that's something you have to get right. Otherwise, your scanner does not work properly. So scanners are not going to be as easy as you might fear, but we're going to be able to automate it. Once the scanner's done, we'll get into the parser. The parser will take individual words and decide if it can make sense out of them. That's something that's fairly difficult in human languages because words are used in such odd ways. I obviously had a thing, you probably don't go that far back, but I always worried about being at the university, we have foreign students. And you may have seen old TV shows where the slang used to be, if somebody particularly liked something, it was bad. So you'd see this great outfit and say, oh, that's bad. But just imagine that you happen to be a foreign student or somebody not familiar with the jargon. You got this bright new suit that you're all happy about, and somebody walks up to you and say, that's bad. You go, like, wait, my gosh, what have I done wrong? And all that. And it simply, here's the case where we've redefined, in some sense, what the term means. And the question is, should we allow that or not in programming languages? That is, should we allow something that means the exact opposite of what it seems to mean be valid or not? It even gets worse than that, again, using the English language analogy. English language words are overloaded. That means they can have multiple meanings. But programming language symbols can also be overloaded also. In terms of English, sometimes figuring out the overloading is very difficult. For example, if I steal a Porsche and leave it in the outskirts of Phoenix, Arizona for the cops to find, what do they find? They find a hot, hot, hot car. Why? Well, what's one of the meanings of hot? Stolen. A car is stolen. I just stole it. It's a Porsche. It must be some of you own Porsches. That's not a bad car. So what's another meaning of hot? Cool. Cool, right. And if I leave something in a desert too long, what does it become? Hot. So you have a hot, hot, hot car. Well, that seems kind of funny. English allows that. But in some cases, if we have a language that allows overloading, Java does that, for example, where I may allow the same name to represent, for example, a constructor or a method with multiple parameters. I have to decide which of those definitions is valid. That's not as easy as it seems, because sometimes I can differentiate not on the number of arguments, but on the types of arguments. That is, I can have a call to a constructor that takes an integer parameter. I can also have a call to a constructor, exactly the same name, that takes a floating point parameter or an array or a string. And we have to find ways to make those coexist. So the parser, as it goes along, has to be able to find out all these variations in usages and accommodate them. It's more restrictive than the English language is, as you might imagine, but it's still something that is a chore and something we have to do right. So that's something the parser will do. It'll create, oh, here's our buddy, the abstract syntax tree. So that's where we're starting out. And at this stage, notice the abstract syntax tree can interact with the symbol table, and that's where we create our cross-reference. Project number 4 will be the type checker. That's where we try to make sense out of whether something a person writes down as a program is valid or not in terms of the definition of language. There's an old saying, you can't mix apples and oranges. Well, in terms of programming languages, there's a similar thing that says there are certain types that aren't allowed to interact with other types. So, for example, let me get another clean sheet. I can find one. Oh, here's one that's... there goes one. So it turns out that I can't, in most programming languages, for example, write... which means I can't mix apples and oranges. Oh, whoa, come on, guy. Wait a minute. There, sorry. Here's a case where I'm trying to mix apples and oranges, a string, but a string that represents a valid digit, and plus. Remember, plus is overloaded. I just talked about that. Plus can mean at least two different things. One of the things plus can mean is simple addition. So I might be meaning one. Please translate it from a string to the internal representation of a one, and add one and one and get two. But sometimes one and one does not equal two. You might be meaning, here's one, the string one, and what's another meaning for plus in Java? Concatenation, create a longer string by binding together two smaller strings. And it might be meaning, hey, please convert one to a string. And therefore, I would have one followed by the digit one, four letters long. Another possible meaning. The compiler doesn't need know which you mean, so what do you expect it does? It says no, not allowing it, because either translation might be possible, but we don't know which is the intended one. If we guess right, we're golden. If we guess wrong, we look like schmucks or look like idiots. I don't know if schmuck is politically correct anymore. We look like idiots. So we have a type checker doing that sort of thing, and you'll actually get to implement that, lucky fellows you are and gals. Have a translator, which will translate from the abstract syntax tree to the final code via code generation. And I'll show you all this in just a moment, and actually get an executable program. So let me skip ahead, and then we'll next lecture, we'll go ahead and go over this in more detail. So I have this nice little example, and I think I actually have it out of order. Yeah, here's something where we have a little time. I think we have time. Excellent, we do. So these are the steps you're going to do, and you might want to take this particular page if you have a written copy and make a little mark on it, because in about 3 months, end of April into May, when you have your compiler working, you'll actually be able to take something like this, run it through your compiler, and have it do the steps I'm showing now. So what's going to happen is we're going to be using language called CSX, and here I have some mixed colors because I'm trying to hint at how I want the program to be interpreted. So I'll write down a statement like this. This is actually a valid CSX statement. It's also a valid Java, valid C, valid C++. All these languages have a common heritage and a lot of commonality among them. So this is where I'm going to first go ahead and say, what is this? Well, being experienced programmers, I'm going to add together variable BB and ABS. That's a built-in function called the absolute value. So remember, absolute value strips the sign. So it says compute C minus 7. Strip the minus sign if it's minus, give me the plus version of it, and add it together. And it's going to go ahead and take this from individual characters into the steps that go scanning, parsing, AST, type checking, and find the code generation into something you can actually run. So the first thing it does is it says, well, I've got to figure out where these tokens begin and end. Sometimes I can use blanks. Sometimes I can use various rules. This will be all automated. But the user's intention would be A is meant to be a single identifier. Equal is meant to be the assignment. BB is not two variables. It's one spelled with two letters. Plus is the plus operator. ABS is an identifier which, because of the parens, happens to be the name of a function. Inside the parentheses is an argument. It's an expression which I'll compute, and I'll compute it by taking the variable C and subtracting 7. And then I end it all up with a semicolon. So at this stage, the scanner goes ahead and changes these to individual tokens. And here's a list of those represented simply as enumeration values. So the ID says what it is. The subscript says here's the content of it. So I have an identifier named A, an assignment operator, an identifier named B, a plus operator, an identifier named ABS, the left paren, the identifier named C. I'm just breaking this at this stage to fit it on the page. The minus operator, the int literal, numeric 7, the right paren, and the semicolon. This is still fairly low level. What the parser will do is go ahead and build a tree out of it. And this is the beginning of our abstract syntax tree. So this is not too dissimilar to what you'll be working on in Project 1. It's gone ahead and said, even though this began with an identifier, that's not really what this is. What is this thing I saw? It's an assignment operator. So it'll say, I'm an assignment right at the root. No doubt about it. It's not an if. It's not a declaration. It's an assignment. Assignment has two components. One is the target variable being assigned to, and the other is some sort of expression that's computed and assigned. So the left-hand side is typically an identifier or a field or a subscripted variable. It's named A. And here's a whole expression which you got to figure out how to compute to give me the right answer. So it says this is an addition. The left operand is the identifier variable BB. The next thing is a call. That means you have to go ahead and recognize there's something called a function call or a method call. It always has a name, and it has some number of parameters. In this case, 1. That parameter is an expression computed by doing a minus operation on the identifier C and the int literal. All this is figured out by the parser almost automatically. So you start out with this fairly linear sequence, and all of a sudden a tree pops out, and that gives you structure. You can see the assignment. You can see the left-hand side, the right-hand side. You can see the components that need to be computed. So this is a big step forward. And this is actually at the point in which you'd be doing Project 1, something like this. The next thing it says is, does this make sense? What are the types on this? So certain things, it's going to do exactly what you're going to do, namely look up the symbol table. So it's going to look up identifier A, and let's assume it's all valid, and says, hey, I know what that guy is. It's an integer location. Location means it's a memory location I can assign into. B is an integer location, but not ABS. ABS is a method because it's been declared elsewhere. And in that particular case, I have to do a call. It says, here's a minus. C is an integer location. Int literal is an int. So now it does some type checking. The type of int literal is int. The type of ID is int. If I subtract an int from an int, the rules are the result is an int. So this minus guy is going to create an integer. It says, here's a call. It's to a method, and its parameter is an integer. So it says, if I have ABS of an integer, what's the result type going to be? It's going to be an integer. Turns out ABS is oftentimes overloaded, so I can take the absolute value of a real number, floating point, or integer, and they both coexist. So in this case, it says, hey, I'm an integer. Well, it says, okay, I'm going to do an addition. An int location in an integer will result in an integer. And finally, it says, I'm going to assign an integer into an int location. So the net effect of this to assign an integer. So it's gone ahead and done some checking and make sure I haven't made any type errors. Good. That means I'm getting close to being able to translate it. At this stage, this looks terrible. But I'll explain this to you as we get to code generation. But this is really what the JVM is like. Finally, we get to the stage, what do these things mean? Well, they mean individual instructions. Each one of these lines is an instruction to Java Virtual Machine that says, do some elementary step. What are these? Well, We'll have to learn some of the codes, but I'll have documentation on this. I stands for integer, and load stands for load. What's this three? Well, it turns out each local variable is giving an index. Your number one, number two, number three, etc. So it says, go ahead and load from the third local variable, which happens to be named BB. Where do we load it? We load it onto what amounts to a stack. This is a stack-oriented machine. So in this stage, it's going to put BB on the stack, but not as the letters BB, but actual number. So this is the value of BB as found in memory. What's the next one? It says, do an I load of 2. That says, that's the second variable, that's C. So that's going to be the value of C. LDC stands for load constant. That says, don't worry about a memory location. Take the constant, in this case 7, and push it onto the operand stack. So I have those three values sitting there. The calculation is partially but not completely done. Next thing says is do a subtraction. And in fact, an I sub says do an integer subtraction. Subtraction takes two values. Where does it find them? Finds them on the top and top minus one of the stack and subtracts them. So this takes the value of C and 7, replaces that with the numeric value of C minus 7. The next thing I have to do is call a method. A method is code written elsewhere, so I have to tell it where to find it. And it turns out in Java, remember, they have all these packages. Well, it turns out packages are separated by dots. In this notation, they use slashes because dots are used for decimal points. So it says find in Java, java.lang.math, a method called ABS. This is the standard one out of the standard library. And it says take the one whose operand is integer and whose result is integer and call that. So when it comes back, it takes the value C minus 7 on the stack and replaces it with the absolute value of that. But that's now an actual numeric value, not symbolic. I'm just trying to keep track of what it should mean. It then says do and a subtraction. I'm sorry, an addition. Addition takes two values. So it's going to take BB and ABS. And finally, it says do a store. Take the value sitting on top of the stack and put it back in memory. Well, the assignment was into A. A is local variable 1. So I store into 1 says store into the first local variable you declared that value, which is BB minus ABS of C minus 7. So guess what? It's gone ahead and translated that bit of code into executable form. And if you let the JVM execute it, that is the program you get when you call Java, you'll get that answer exactly as Java would. And that's exactly what your compiler is going to do. It's going to verify the program's correct, put it into a tree, check the tree for further correctness, and then step by step translate it into individual simple steps that the JVM knows how to execute. When you put it together, you've got yourself a working program. So that's a pretty cool thing. And I think we're just about out of time. Yeah, 2 minutes. Guess what? First day, I'm going to give you a break. We'll give you 2 minutes extra, and we actually got you out of here at 8:30. So the plan is I have some work to do from people who gave me some information. I'll work on that. I'll be in office hours next 2 days from now on Thursday. Send email or contact through Piazza if you're having problems, and we'll see you hopefully a week from today.